The following program is sponsored by Learn to Succeed, LLC. It's not right-wing radio. It's not left-wing radio.
It's not left-wing radio.
It's think-wing radio. Welcome to think-wing radio. And now your host, Mike Honig.
Good afternoon. I hope you had a good lunch. Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Talk 650, powered by CBS. You can now visit our new, easier-to-remember website at thinkwingradio.com, where we have articles, voters' information, there is now an audio archive, and more. You can also email me comments or opinions, either by putting them on the website or sending them to my email at thinkwingradio@msn.com. And I'd like to know very much what you think of the website, so please drop by and give me your opinions and suggestions. My guest today is Dr. Ross Burkhardt, an associate professor of political science at Boise State University. He's done extensive research and writing on the impact of political policy on factors such as economic development, human rights, and environmental issues. He has a sterling reputation, I am told, as an expert on the international growth of democracy and what political and economic factors can foster or stall the growth of a viable democratic government. His published books include the recently released Turmoil in American Public Society, Science, Democracy, and the Environment. His works have been featured in publications such as Social Science Quarterly and Social Science Journal, and he serves as co-director of the Canadian Studies Program at Boise State University. Today, we are going to be discussing politics, political labels, elections, and many other politically related topics. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and Dr. Burkhardt. How are you today?
Doing great, Mike. Thanks for having me on your program.
It's a great pleasure. I've actually been trying to get a political scientist on here for a while, and they're just, I guess, hard to pull away from their classes.
You've got one. Yes, yes, you found the in-between classes.
Very, very excited. There are so many things to start with. I guess maybe the first thing that I want to talk about is political labels.
Okay.
You hear people throwing around words like liberal and libertarian and fascist and Nazi and communist and socialist. And when you see people call someone a Nazi, socialist, fascist, you know that they don't have a clue what they're talking about. So can we talk a little about what these different labels represent so that if people are going to insult someone by calling them that, they at least know what they're calling them?
I'd be happy to try my best to talk about these things. Sure, absolutely.
Okay, let's start with the difference between a liberal and a conservative.
Okay. And my reference here will be the United States.
Yes.
The liberals and the conservatives can be roughly divided into the degree to which government is involved in helping to increase quality of life. And a liberal will have a more favorable view of government intervention in the economy, government helping to provide social services, and helping to thus raise the quality of life for those who do not have as much in terms of resources. And conservatives tend to view the government as more of a hindrance than as a positive helping force, if you will. So conservatives will say that the government that governs best governs very little, does not intervene in the economy, allows private business, private enterprise to provide the economic necessities for people, and that all people get raised up when business does well. So a conservative, from an economic standpoint, will want to see government intervene less in the economy. So that's one way to think of the divide between liberals and conservatives. And another way to think about it is in terms of social divide. And that's certainly a big one in this particular election, as charges and countercharges are thrown around about who's a liberal, who's a conservative. They often think in terms of social values. And liberals tend to view social values in perhaps a more more permissive perspective. So they liberals would tend to favor abortion rights, the right to choose. And conservatives would favor more of a traditional view on society. So less permissive, more restrictive in that sense. So,
now,
yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry. As a layperson, and of course this is always dangerous when you're talking to a specialist, but as a layperson, I think I might quibble with a couple of your definitions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of liberals as being permissive, although I think that that's a label that conservatives place on them. When you look at the things you talked about, like gay rights and a woman's right to choose, the liberals, surprisingly, when you start to look at them detachedly, are actually more interested in individual freedom.
Uh-huh.
The conservatives, who claim to be interested in getting government out of your life, actually get more involved in personal restriction, although they're very, very big on business freedom. Would that be something that you would agree or disagree with or qualify?
No, I think that's a reinterpretation of the basic point that that conservatives would view government as being a little more interventionist, let's say, in terms of regulating social values and not supporting gay rights, not supporting abortion rights. So that I think is fairly consistent with what a conservative would say. And so I guess there is kind of an opposite relationship between government intervention in the economy and government intervention in terms of providing for a platform on social values.
I think that part of what makes this a very, very important distinction for me is because you hear, and you sent me a couple of articles prior to the show that I looked at that we may touch upon, but they talk now about the narrative, the Democratic narrative, the Republican narrative. And the Republican narrative has been to make into pejoratives, make into insults or negative buzzwords certain things that are typically associated with liberals. For example, the very word liberal now has become almost a pejorative to the point where even Democrats call themselves progressives. Mm-hmm. Or, for example, the use of the word permissive in terms of gay rights, woman's right to choose, right to privacy. That, I think, would be a skewed label. Because permissive words have power, and they have power in subtle ways that people don't even recognize when those words impact them. And permissive means, oh, they're going to be wild in the streets, or, you know, they're going to just allow anything goes. And that's the trouble I have with the opposition choosing to define what their opponents are.
Because the opposition will always try to define you as being weaker or in some way incorrect or immoral. So the word permissive or liberal implies some sort of weakness. And this goes back, I think, to visions of the 1960s, and it also goes back to foreign policy visions. For instance, who is going to be the toughest on the Soviet Union? Who is going to provide the strongest leadership? And liberals ended up being tagged with the label of being, well, we're not the strongest. We are weaker. And liberals, in that sense, have been labeled rather successfully in this election cycle, it seems, as not being strong enough to stand up to the forces that are governing politics in this country.
Okay, we are getting ready to take a break. When we come back, we're going to touch on the question of the differences between conservatives, neoconservatives, and libertarians, and perhaps even anarchists. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on Talk 650 and 650Houston.com. My guest is Dr. Ross Burkhart, Associate Professor at Boise University of Political Science, and we will be right back. Okay, we're back, and you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig here on Talk 650 and 650Houston.com. And my guest today is Dr. Ross Burkhart, Associate Professor of Political Science at Boise State University. Remember, you can always send comments on this or any other show or any other topic on your mind to thinkwingradio@msn.com. And the website is thinkwingradio.com, and we are now archiving past shows there for you to listen to. So, Dr. Burkhart, conservative, neoconservative, and libertarian. Now, to my lay ears, you have used some terms for conservative that I would almost assign to either neoconservatives or libertarians, at least based on my perception. Conservative to me, whenever I have looked it up, is traditional values, yes, smaller government, but all of these other issues are really culture war issues that go to, I think, neoconservatism. Would that be fair?
Somewhat fair, yes. Neoconservatism came about as a result of the 1960s, which I mentioned before the break. The neocons were, in fact, back in the day, back in the early 1960s, were liberals. They had a reaction, I think, to what had happened in the 1960s, what they had seen as what they would call permissiveness. And neoconservatives, in terms of social values, I think see themselves more defined as a group of people who really don't want to see society what they would call run amok. A neoconservative thus has that perspective on social issues. But neoconservatism also became a popular term in the early 2000s. After 9/11, Bush administration drafted a new strategy, kind of a new defense strategy, and this strategy was also labeled a neoconservative strategy, which would aggressively fight the war on terror and would spend whatever would be needed, whatever was necessary in terms of defense and homeland security.
I would have the impression that there are two fundamental things that differentiate neoconservatism from classical, what I would call classical conservatism. One would be that they are very interventionist.
I think that's correct.
Conservatives
yes.
have traditionally been isolationist.
Uh-huh.
And
yes.
I think the other thing is this whole cultural war aspect, which I think conservatives have always felt a distinction between society as visualized by liberals and society as visualized by conservatives. But I don't think it had the characteristics of a culture war the way it does now, where there is this full press push to get religion back in schools and teach creationism or intelligent design, which is really just creationism. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think that is a fair assessment. Neoconservatism is meant to be kind of a refresher, sort of a breath of fresh air into the conservative movement. And part of this breath of fresh air, I think, is to take head on these divisive social issues and cast them in a little bit more of a religious and religious fundamentalist stance. So I think that is a fair way of looking at the notion of neoconservatism.
Now, neoconservative versus libertarian versus anarchism, which is really a term that probably went out of fashion in the 1920s or 1930s, if my history is right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, from the cursory research I've done, I don't see a lot of difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's go through.
You know, so libertarianism to me simply looks like a rebranding of anarchism when you see how similar they are.
It is a bit of a rebranding of anarchism, yes. But I think anarchism is perhaps even more extreme, and it suggests the total absence of the state, that an anarchist world is one in which people can come together and work within a framework, a community framework, that doesn't require the state to be present. I'm not sure that libertarians quite go that far. I think libertarians may see in their eyes the need for a state for basic security needs, security measures, defense of the nation's territory.
Well, I think that anarchism is a lot like vegetarianism, which is to say there are a lot of different flavors. You have people that don't eat any animal products at all, and then you have people that will eat eggs and cheese because it doesn't require harm to the animal, and et cetera. And I think that when you compare libertarianism to anarchism, just like there are degrees of libertarianism, you know, there's libertarianism with cultural war, there's libertarianism without cultural war, there are lots of different levels of it. And I think when you look at anarchism, the flavors that understand there has to be some kind of central control in order to protect individuals from physical harm, when you start to look simply at the elements of no regulation, no government interference, smallest government, the best government is the government that governs least. Mm-hmm. When you take out the most extreme anarchist beliefs, which are no government, everyone's great by themselves, then I think you start to see a lot of similarity, or no?
I think you're right, and I think that's what makes this be a great discussion. It's a very interesting and informative discussion about how people view politics. So when you say there are different shades, different flavors of libertarianism or anarchism or conservatism or liberalism, that's absolutely true. So I think when people try to think about what am I? Am I a liberal? Am I a conservative? Am I an anarchist? Am I a combination of the bunch? It's okay to think in these kind of variations. So we're really, really painting some broad definitional brushstrokes here when we talk about these terms. But I do think that that there are a lot of similarities between being a libertarian and being an anarchist. It seems to me that you mentioned that anarchism had gone out of style in the 1920s.
As a movement.
Yeah, the movement. It always struck me as being a movement from the left, that an anarchist was someone who believed more in the equality of people, and that a state would hinder that notion of equality. I mean, it seems to come more from the left. Whereas when we think of libertarians, especially today, libertarians seem to come more from the right and from a very limited government sense, and that a government really needs to be cut back, or certain departments in the government need to be abolished.
Selective departments. It's the departments you don't want.
Yes. And the departments that you don't think are essential for a society, for the betterment of a society. So I think libertarians come at it from a slightly different angle than anarchists, but both do have rather similar looks to them in that they certainly don't want to see big government.
Now, you know, you made a very interesting point. First of all, I just want to go back to something. Did you say that neoconservatives started out as liberals, or did I mishear that?
No, there are several neoconservatives who started off as liberals. I'm thinking of David Horowitz, for instance, and others like him who are more certainly more of the left at the beginning of yeah. their political careers, and I really became profoundly dissatisfied with liberalism.
That's intriguing.
As an ideology.
And you also made the point that anarchists, when you look at some of that philosophy, they do look kind of liberal in terms of they want individual rights. I think that what's interesting is when you go to what had been libertarianism under Ron Paul, and we're going to have to take a break in a moment. Well, why don't we leave it at that? We're going to talk about libertarianism under Ron Paul. And you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig here on Talk 650 and 650Houston.com with my guest, Dr. Ross Burkhardt of the Department of Political Science at Boise State University. Remember, you can always go to the website at thinkwingradio.com where we are putting up archives of previous shows you can listen to. And you can also write at thinkwingradio.com. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and we will be right back. Okay, we're back. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on Talk 650 and 650Houston.com with my guest, Dr. Ross Burkhardt of the Boise State University Department of Political Science. You can always listen to previous shows at thinkwingradio.com, and you can write to me at thinkwingradio at msn.com. Dr. Burkhardt, before the break, I had touched on what might be perceived, and you may change my mind, of Ron Paul libertarianism versus perhaps Rand Paul libertarianism. I have known of Ron Paul for many, many years. I think he's been a congressman here since the 1980s. And when you listen to Ron Paul, you have, if this doesn't sound like a contradiction in terms, a much clearer distinction between, how can I rephrase that? It's almost a much more confusing mixture of liberalism and conservatism. Mm-hmm. So that a lot of the college students who are supporting Ron Paul for president, you know, they hear, I believe in a woman's right to choose, and I believe in gay rights, which actually would be very much part of classic libertarianism, you know, basically personal rights. And then you get to someone like Rand Paul, who actually sounds like he is a libertarian who's gone a step beyond, who sees no role for government, essentially. To the point of, you know, don't regulate BP, don't worry about government intervention in oil spills, don't get involved, government shouldn't get involved in treating people in a racist way, forbidding them to go to restaurants and such. There seems to be a little bit of distance between the Ron Paul version of libertarianism and the Rand Paul version, unless I am mistaken. What would be your opinion on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think I can change your opinion on that.
Oh, it does.
Yes, it does. It does seem like Rand Paul is quite an extreme version of what we would call libertarianism.
So a libertarian rebellious kid.
Perhaps so. Perhaps so. There may be some other reasons as well. I'm only speculating here, but I think that there may be some way that we can conceive of this as a political newcomer, Rand Paul, striking out on his own and providing his own political philosophy, and having that political philosophy be relatively fresh today. He has certainly commanded the national media spotlight and media attention with his primary election victory and his continued very strong campaign in Kentucky, which would be kind of a new area, I think, in terms of libertarian thought, a new area of the country. So it's rather possible that what we have here is a newer politician providing newer stances and opinions that may clash a little bit with his father's interpretation of libertarianism.
All right. We've touched on what might be the distinctions between conservatives, neoconservatives, and libertarians. Let's talk about the other side of the spectrum. What would be the differences between liberals, socialists, democratic socialists, and then you get to communism, which is kind of the left-wing version, I suppose, of fascism, although I think, you can't be a communist and a fascist.
No, I don't think so.
So
okay.
Let's talk about that, and then let's talk about the difference between communism and fascism, which seem to be conjoined in a lot of people's minds.
Okay, sure. So from the left, a liberal does have a generalized belief in capitalism, which is the private ownership of property in general, private ownership of property, and that is the best engine for economic growth and development. And then from there, if we head toward democratic socialism and then ultimately communism, I think socialism is the birthplace of both democratic socialism and communism. In fact, in some ways, you could argue that communism is the application of socialism.
Communism is almost to socialism, perhaps, as libertarianism is to conservatism.
I think that's fair. I think that's a fair way of trying to discern these different ideologies. Socialism, in contrast to liberalism, suggests that the public ownership of the economy is, in fact, the fairest, most equitable, and ultimately the preferred driver of economic growth and development.
But we're talking major sectors. We're not talking down to your street vendor.
Absolutely, yes.
That's a difference between socialism and communism.
Yes, absolutely. Socialism, as it's evolved through its three plus centuries of political thought, has concentrated mainly on what's called nationalization of major industries. Mm-hmm. So, nationalizing the railways, nationalizing the steel industry,
power grids.
Absolutely, yes. These are major industrial enterprises, and if the state has a role in the production of products from these industries, then the state also is able to regulate those industries by definition, providing for the public good, and certainly public utilities have that type of flavor to them. Even though they're privately owned, the idea is to provide for the public good. The ownership of these large industries will thus provide for the benefit of all, and that is really what socialism strives for.
Now, this is going to be maybe a hard question because this is a really gray boundary. When does a government go from being socialist to being communist? Or phrased another way, when does a business or enterprise become big enough that it becomes a target of a socialist takeover by a socialist government?
Okay. Yeah, those are two separate questions. Let me take the first one. I think that in the world of a Marxist or a communist, it's not just the ownership of large scale production. It is the common ownership of the economy. So it's something that's even a little bit more extreme. So a communist state would be one where there is common ownership over the entirety of the economy. So that is
down to the street vendor.
Yes. So that goes further than does socialism or democratic socialism. You'd mentioned that earlier. Democratic
right.
socialism is sort of socialism light. It's a bit of a it combines elements of liberalism and socialism. So if you find yourself sort of heading more toward socialism but not quite there, you can probably call yourself a democratic socialist.
Light. I love that.
Yeah. So there's that, and then I'm sorry, your second question, if you don't mind.
Well, we have about a minute 15 to talk about where the boundary is between when the government wants to be involved in a sector or a particular business or industry, and where the government is content to leave it in private hands.
Okay. We find this tendency, especially after cataclysmic events such as wartime, and after war, the state, and this happened in Western Europe, the state found itself to be really the only institution that was effectively standing and still acting. So the tendency would be to try to seize ownership of major industries in order to bring them back, in order to help them, help the country become the industrial power that it was prior to the war.
But
so,
in 15 seconds, and we can come back to this after the break, where would be the boundary? When would the government feel it's important enough that they have to be financially involved?
Well, that's a tough question to answer in 15
seconds. Well, good. We can come back to it after the break in more detail. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Talk 650 and 650Houston.com with my guest, Dr. Ross Burkhart of Boise State University Political Science Department. And again, the website is thinkwingradio.com. The email is thinkwingradio@msn.com. And you can listen now to archived shows there, and we will be right back. Okay, you're back listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Talk 650 and 650Houston.com with my guest, Dr. Ross Burkhart associate professor at the Boise State University Political Science Department. And we had left off at where that boundary line is between a socialist or a democratic socialist government allowing enterprise to remain in private hands and where it starts to get into that neighborhood where they start to think about maybe nationalizing it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. So I think there are a couple of issues here. First of all, the state may be concerned about the performance of that industry, and if there is any question about whether or not the railways, in fact, have the resources on their own to operate and provide for sufficient public transportation, if there's any question about that, then the state may choose to intervene. So that's one. One standard that could be used. Second standard could be an ideological standard. If the government itself is of an ideology that thinks that public ownership is inherently a good thing for the state to be pursuing, that the benefits of running that industry can be better distributed throughout society, then that state may just have simply an ideological predisposition to go ahead and nationalize that industry.
You actually see a seesaw sometimes in countries like Britain where it's like they nationalize, they privatize, they nationalize, they privatize.
They do. And so there's the sense that they're trying to find the right mix. It's not merely the government of the day who makes these decisions. I think that the privatization of the rail industry in Britain may have been accomplished by governments previous to those of John Major if they felt that the political will was there in the public, but it just wasn't there. So there's a lot to consider when an industry ends up being nationalized or denationalized, as we're talking about in the case of Britain.
All right. Now let's talk about the difference between communists and fascists and between fascists and Nazis. And they are not the same thing.
No, they're not the same thing. I think both fascists and Nazis share a bit more of what we would call nationalism. And nationalism is a very potent force in politics. And nationalism is basically the feeling or tendency toward a national identity. Nations are not the same thing as countries. A nation can be a people that has a common heritage to them.
Point.
Yeah, so the notion of nationalism can come from people with a shared history, a shared language, shared customs. And so the idea of nationalism, as invoked by fascists and especially by the Nazis, is one that tries to go back in time to reproduce some sort of what is really a mythical era of a national identity. And that's a very, very powerful force. For instance, we see it today in disputes over a very small island chain called the Senkaku Islands down close to Taiwan. Japan claims sovereignty over them. Taiwan and China both dispute that, and there's a lot of public protest and diplomatic protest over the status of the Senkakus, provoked by an incident about a month ago where a Chinese fisherman was detained by the Japanese Coast Guard because he appeared to be interfering with their operations right by the Senkaku Islands. A lot of the feeling about this is a nationalist feeling. So I think that's something that distinguishes communism, which is more of an economic theory about how an economy should run, and fascism and Nazism, which is about invoking an image of a state. An image of national identity.
Now, my understanding from my cursory research, communism, yeah, I think I can actually see what you're talking about, because it's loyalty to the state, which I guess gives birth to a form of nationalism.
Of sorts, yeah.
Now, fascism, I have heard or read, is really about the fact that you have a dominant state that may be a faux democracy or may not, but business serves the state. It's not stripped, ownership is not stripped away by the state, but business is sort of, big business is sort of in cahoots with the state. So state serves business interests, but big business ultimately yields to the needs and desires of the state.
Right.
Nazism and, would be fascism with a racist face.
Yes, yes. I think that that's pretty much on track. A fascist state, and famously invoking Mussolini in Italy, the fascists made the trains run on time.
Yes.
The idea of that
is the efficiency of a business in government. That's what we want. That's what the Republicans keep asking for. Business efficiency. Mussolini had it.
Yes, well, the
you see, that's the reference we need to frame.
The notion of business working for government or working for the state, more generally speaking, is also meant to suggest not just an efficiency, but also that business promotes the nationhood. The boundaries of national identity are enhanced by having business work on behalf of the state. So the power of fascism is that it helps to preserve national identity. And as you mentioned, there can be some faux or pretend democratic procedures and processes that happen within a fascist state. But the real point of the fascist state is to promote or perpetuate a leader or an authoritarian political figure who ends up becoming the embodiment of that state and the embodiment of national identity. So the power of fascism really is rooted in that sort of nationalist idea.
I think I'm going to take the last minute more or less for myself, because I want to talk about this notion of running government like a business. The thing about that is when you want to talk constitutional purism, government is not intended to run like a business. Government is not intended to run efficiently. The whole point of having three branches with conflicting powers is you want government to be inefficient. The people that are complaining that government is too big, we want to run it more like a business so it's more efficient, actually have missed the point. They're at the total opposite wrong end of the argument. You want government to be inefficient. That's what protects your rights. You make it too efficient, then you're in serious trouble. I am going to have to thank at this point, because I took the last minute for myself, thank you, Dr. Ross Burkhardt. You have the book out now, Turmoil in American Public Society, Science, Democracy, and the Environment, which I wish you good luck on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being on the show. We will probably have to do this again. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Talk 650 and 650Houston.com. Remember the website, thinkwingradio.com. And remember, slower traffic, keep right. It's not just a good idea. It's the law. Thank you very much for listening. I'll speak to you next week. Bye-bye.